try to yourself. Hurry now, cause I got to go. What's the matter now? What's the matter now? God, I'm quitting. Your ass got to go. Ain't gonna sing no more. Ain't gonna sing no more. I'm gonna leave from here. Ain't come back no more.
Turner Parrish, entitled The Graveyard Blues. That's from a disc called Down and Black Bottom, Low Down Barrel House Piano.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
The University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Again, I knew I wanted to be in commercial real estate, but I didn't know anybody. So my sister happened to be dating a politician who was an important guy in town, Michael Hightower. So I called Michael. It made sense to me. Let me call the most influential person I knew to see if he knew anybody. And he did. He introduced me to a guy named Bill Comer. And I asked Bill, is it possible for me to come and shadow you because I'm thinking about getting into commercial real estate? He said, I'll work it out. It may not be with me, but it'll be somebody in my shop. It ended up being a guy named Steve Gaultney. Steve was kind enough to allow me to shadow him, and he took me around, showed me some listings and some properties that he sold before and clients that he was working with. He said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. Don't say anything, but you can sit in on a meeting and listen.
T. Dallas Smith, founder and CEO of T. Dallas Smith and Company, the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the country. For more than a decade and a half, TDS and Company has taken pride in catering to the needs of clients requiring office space, industrial facilities, and land. Headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, with affiliate offices in Boston, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, and Short Hills, New Jersey, their projects span the nation. In 1989, Smith became the first African-American broker at Cushman & Wakefield of Georgia. 6 years later, he would go on to pioneer the brokerage division of Atlanta's landmark African-American-owned real estate and construction firm, H.J. Russell & Company. Throughout his career, Smith had dedicated himself to exposing African-Americans to the commercial real estate industry. In case you weren't aware, less than 4% of commercial real estate executives are African-American. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, T. Dallas Smith and Company with founder and CEO T. Dallas Smith in Black America.
December 2006, I was partners with another guy, had another company I was partners with, but that company was kind of going under. But during that process, I met a young man who happened to be 19, came to me and wanted to get into real estate. And a lot of people would do that. Nobody years, I would say, do you have your license? And people typically say, no, I don't. I say, get your license. We'll talk. I've done it other years for at least 50 people, and nobody ever came back. But this kid, Leonte Benton, came back in 3 weeks with his license, which is unheard of. And at this point, I'm going, okay, the company I'm a part of is kind of about to go under. I get the epiphany that this kid is a lot like me, and that what I really need to do is start a brokerage company, and I can help this guy and help other people who look like me get into the space.
Under T. Dallas Smith leadership, his commercial real estate firm, T. Dallas Smith & Company, will go on to work with some of the largest companies in the nation, from Microsoft and Coca-Cola to AT&T and FedEx. Born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, Smith grew up in an all-black neighborhood in Hunter Hills. But when his family moved to College Park, it was an eye-opener. He quickly learned that the color of his skin would dramatically affect his experience in the world. Smith knew early on he wanted to make a lot of money, and commercial real estate would make that happen. In 2006, Smith was at the height of his commercial real estate career. He had been mentored early on by Thomas W. Taft and would later pioneer the brokerage division of H.J. Russell & Company, where he served as the division vice president. Today, T. Dallas Smith & Company is the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the nation. Recently in Black America, spoke with T. Dallas Smith.
Yeah, I tell people I'm Atlanta born, Atlanta bred. When I die, I'll be Atlanta dead. I love this city. And that statement came from somebody named Raphael Ben Hill, who actually used to be a radio guy. Mm-hmm. But it's a true statement. And grateful. When I grew up in the West Side in Hunter Hill. It was paradise. Everybody took care of one another. I didn't have to worry about anybody breaking your house or anything like that. It was just a wonderful place. But unfortunately, we moved in 76 when a lot of other folks who looked like us moved out of our communities and moved out into the suburbs. Mm-hmm. You know, as a 62-year-old man, I was 14 when that happened, but now at 62, I know we messed up. You know, it was. We thought we were going somewhere better, but you know, the day we moved there was the first day I was called the N-word. We were the first family on our street in College Park, and so I got thrown into this race thing really quick because I grew up in an all-black family, all-black community. I never dealt with anything racial until we moved to College Park, and I got a crash course real fast about, you know, some folks don't want to see you coming to their community. So I dealt with that at 14, and I tell this story, and the sad thing about it was I really wasn't that upset with the kids who threw rocks at me and called me names. I was more upset with my parents for moving us out of Hunter Hill. And it's full circle for me now. I bought a house in Hunter Hill a couple of years ago, and the plan is to move back to where I all started.
Yeah, I understand. What sparked that interest in real estate?
You know, it's funny. I didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up. The only consistent thing was I knew I wanted to make a lot of money. That was the one consistent thing. So I took a Forbes magazine in 1982 and studied what the richest people in the world did. That was, ironically, the first year they came out with their list of 400 richest people. And I just took this is before computers, and, so I did an old-fashioned index card. I'd write down Warren Buffett, investor, Omaha, Nebraska, and what his net worth. And I did with T. Boone Pickens, oil man, Texas, his net worth. So I did this with all 400 people. And I came out with one conclusion, that the richest people in the world, they do four things, one of four things. And they got to remember, this is 1982. They're in investment business, Wall Street, oil business, that was in Texas. Technology was kind of just coming up. And then this thing called real estate. As I mentioned, I'm from Atlanta. I wanted to stay in Atlanta. So Wall Street would have taken me to New York. Oil would have taken me to Texas. Technology just wasn't my personality. So it left me with real estate. And I was a young man, 19 years old. I had a new car. My dad said if I did well, he'd buy me a new car. I had a Fiat X19 two-seater, emphasis on the two-seater. So I didn't want to take nobody around on the weekends in the car. So that knocked out residential. So I literally just backed into commercial real estate. And so that was really what got it started.
And that first job was Atlanta Air Center Realty?
Atlanta Air Center Realty. I worked with a guy by the name of Thomas W. Tift. Tift County, Tift College. I mean, it was that family. So this was 1982. I happened to, I knew I wanted to be in commercial real estate, but I didn't know anybody. So my sister happened to be dating a politician who was an important guy in town, Michael Hightower. So I called Michael. It made sense to me. Let me call the most influential person I knew to see if he knew anybody. He did. He introduced me to a guy named Bill Comer. And I asked Bill, is it possible for me to come and shadow you because I'm thinking about getting into commercial real estate? He said, I'll work it out. It may not be with me, but it'll be somebody in my shop. It ended up being a guy named Steve Gaultney. Steve was kind enough to allow me to shadow him, and he took me around, showed me some listings and some properties that he sold before and clients that he was working with. He said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. Don't say anything, but you can sit in on a meeting and listen. And so in the meeting, what I did not realize, he was representing the tenant. The guy he was talking to was representing the building. And they were kind of going back and forth. Before we left, they shook hands. We left. He said, do you have any questions? I said, yeah. Well, it looked like it kind of started off a little slow, but it looked like you came to an agreement. He said, yes, we did. I said, I just got one question. I said, how much money are you going to make? He laughed. He said, I'll make $30,000 off that transaction. This is in 1982, when the median income for a family of four was $28,000. And I just saw this guy do that, relatively easy. So I was like, yeah, this is for me. And so I didn't look back. But he was kind enough to take me to lunch. And while I was at lunch, I met a guy named Tom Thompson. Tom told me about Mr. Tiff, and they say the rest is history. But I worked with Mr. Tiff for 6 years. He taught me the game, so I was on the landlord side for the first 6 years in the industry and went through my first recession. Mm-hmm. And didn't ever want to be stuck with just buildings. I wanted to be able to represent tenants and take them anywhere, regardless of what the market might do. And that's what got me into tenant rep, and I had not looked back. That was almost 43 years ago.
After those 6 years, did you go out on your own or you went to another company?
So, yeah, after the first 6 years with Mr. Tiff, I ended up going to work for Cushman & Wakefield in 1989. And at Cushman, I was the first black broker that Cushman hired in Georgia. They were owned by the Rockefellers, which was interesting. The MO was, if you didn't come from money, you didn't work with Cushman & Wakefield. Cushman was known as the Blue Bloods. And I didn't come from the Blue Bloods. My dad drove a taxi and worked at Lockheed. My mama kept kids at the house. So it was God's grace and his determination to place my feet where I needed to be. And so I ended up being at Cushman. Learned a lot. Learned a whole lot. One of the things how me and 40 other brokers, and I say it that way because I was never really in the pack. So that was really what I would describe as the island moment. But thank God for Mr. Tiff. I knew how to work hard, and nobody was going to outwork me. So grateful for that. And but yeah, it was Cushman & Wakefield. I was there for 6 years.
How did H.J. Russell and Company play in what you're doing now?
So Herman Russell, when I came to Cushman, the very first cold call I ever made was to Herman Russell. And left a voicemail message. Well, not a voicemail message. I spoke with his assistant. His assistant was named Barbara. Basically told Barbara I was the first black broker at Cushman & Wakefield. Wanted to meet with Mr. Russell. You know, he was somebody who I idolized my whole life. And as a business person, wanting to be a business person as stellar as he was, I know I could learn a lot from him. Not sure what else I said, but that was kind of the pitch. And she said, okay, well, I'll tell him you called. And after that, I just realized I thought it was going to take, you know, years, months, years to get a hold of him. But to my surprise, he called me in less than 15 minutes. He called me right back.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically just mumbled something because I was in the break room when he called me back. And I had a whole script of what I was going to say to him at my desk. And I just laughed, and I told him, I said, Mr. Russell, I said, I didn't think you would call me back that quick. I'm in the break room. I've got a whole script at my desk of things I was going to say to you. He just started laughing. I said, but really at the end of the day, I said, I don't know how we may be able to help one another or if I can help you, but I've seen your career, and I've watched you, and I want to one day be a businessman like you are, and I'd love to meet you. And he had me meet with Noah Khalil, who was running his development business. We met, and literally – walking in the hallway after leaving Noel Khalil, I bumped into Jerome Russell, Herman's son. And he knocked my portfolio out of my hand and helped me pick my business cards up. And he saw the business card, Cushman & Wakefield, T. Dallas. And he said, you're T. Dallas, man? I said, yeah. He said, and you work with Cushman? I said, yes. He said, you work with Cushman? I said, yes. So he said, well, we got to get together. I've always been interested in commercial real estate. But that's how Jerome and I got together, and we got together, and we would meet once a month to break bread and just to talk about real estate. We did this for 3 years. And in one of those meetings, he said, well, when I become president of H.J. Russell & Company, I want you to come over here and start a brokerage division for us. And true to his word, the day he became president of the company, he called and said, man, you ready to go to work? So I ended up working for H.J. Russell & Company, started a brokerage division for Herman, worked there for 6 years, and I tell you, man, I tell people I earned my PhD working for Herman. I mean, he's got the blueprint for how it ought to be done. And so really all I've been doing and executing at T. Dallas Smith & Company is what I saw Herman Russell do.
What are some of the projects or clients that you all had at H.J. Russell?
When I was at H.J. Russell, we had Bell South as a client. I got to go back, man. I want to say we did something for Matt Chrysler. I'm going back. I was in my 30s, man. I'm 62 now. But the ones that stand out is Bell South, because we're still T. Dallas Smith & Company. We're still representing AT&T now to this day. We're still doing work with them now. But I was doing some stuff at that time for Walmart, for Target, sort of retail development. And then I was helping Herman purchase a lot of property. So if you've ever been to Atlanta and mm-hmm. been to the Pascals off of Fair Street, Northside Drive and Fair, that whole block I helped H.J. acquire over an eight-year period. So what I saw this man do, who had a speech impediment, who grew up at a time when he said he thought his first name was N-word, because mm-hmm. that was the environment. But I saw this man create, you know, at that time, he had over, I know, $500 million worth of real estate. And working with him, he gave you absolutely zero excuses in terms of not being able to accomplish whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. He was simply that guy. He died in 2014, miss him dearly. He's got a book out called Building Atlanta, which I always recommend people to get that book to really understand what this man came from. And a lot of folks who came out of his shop who were doing extremely well because they sat at the man's feet, you know, for so many years. Mm-hmm. So you come out with no excuses, man. Zero.
I understand. This is In Black America. We'll be back after this message.
The Tacos of Texas podcast is wrapping up El Cuatro, and we're celebrating with a taco party on Sunday, November 17th at El Perrito ATX. We'll have a live podcast taping, cumbia beats by DJ Chorizo Funk, and free tacos while they last. The event is free and open to the public, Learn more at KUT.org/taco party.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with T. Dallas Smith, founder and CEO of T. Dallas Smith and Company, the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the nation. Mr. Smith, when did you start your own company, and tell us about that process?
December 2006. I was partners with another guy, had another company I was partners with, but that company was kind of going under. But during that process, I met a young man who happened to be 19, came to me and wanted to get into real estate. And a lot of people would do that. Nobody years, I would say, do you have your license? And people typically say, no, I don't. I say, get your license, we'll talk. And I've done it other years to at least 50 people, and nobody ever came back. But this kid, Leonte Benton, came back in 3 weeks with his license, which is unheard of. And at this point, I'm going, okay, the company I'm a part of is kind of about to go under. I get the epiphany that this kid is a lot like me, and that what I really need to do is start a brokerage company, and I can help this guy and help other people who look like me get into the space. So we became official in March 2007. We became, you know, all the paperwork and everything was done from that December. That intern is now the president of T. Dallas Smith & Company. Within 2 weeks of him being with me, God told me, train him up as a son. But when I turn 60, this would be the one who will be running your company. So when I turned 60 2 years ago, we had a ceremony, a baton handing over the, you know, the presidency of T. Dallas Smith & Company over to him. And I couldn't be happier, man. We've got some great people who are working with us now. We got almost a little bit about 20 people in our shop right now. Not everybody's in production, but we've come a long way, man. We're working with some really great clients. Like I said, we're still working with AT&T. We're still working with FedEx. We've been doing work for them for over 10 years. It's just been great, man. It's what I get more joy in seeing young people who come to my shop who didn't know anything about real estate, you know, make their first $600,000, $100,000. It's nothing like, it's like, you know, just a proud papa moment to see those things happen, man. So I always tell people, obviously God knew the joy that I would get out of this. And I'm so grateful. At the time I thought I was burnt out of real estate. You know, we'll be December this year, be 18 years since that happened. So just grateful, man. Extremely grateful. Blessed. Both my parents are deceased, but my dad got a chance to see sort of the start of it. My mom got to see more. And they were just both happy and grateful to see their little, as my mom would say, her little preemie boy. I was born a preemie, but, you know, I'd be 50 years old. I was still my mama's little boy. And but grateful for my parents, and I got two sisters. Just a great family, man. And just a great business to be in. This is the only business I tell people where you might be broke on a Friday and you could be rich on a Monday. So, commercial real estate tenant representation.
That brings me to my next question. What does it feel like when you sign and cut those six figure checks?
You know, it's the first thing you learn something about Uncle Sam. Number one, you got
exactly.
make sure you get good tax counsel and have a good, you know, lawyer. All of that. So that's the first thing. I think big and small said more money, more problems. But I'd rather have those problems than trying to figure out a place to eat or live and those kind of things. So I'm grateful, man. I just, you know, but, you know, wise counsel, making sure that you've got wise counsel around you, that you don't do all the crazy stuff. Because I tell my young people stupid stuff I did because I tell them. So they don't do it. You know, spend your big, take six, make $100,000, go spend $200,000. Don't do that. You know, a lot of us do that kind of thing. I definitely did that. But, you know, you learn. And I thank God. My dad says, there's no fool like an old fool. And I don't want to be no old fool. So I'm still trying to stay green enough to grow.
Got you.
And keeping people around me who can keep me sharper.
How do you distinguish yourself from your competition?
There's competition out there?
How do you distinguish yourself from the competition? Is there competition out there?
You know, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, what competition are you talking about? No, you know, at the end of the day, man, I'm a big firm believer that what's for you is for you. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing that I always make sure that we focus on is taking care of the client first. It's not about your pocket. It's not about the commission you're going to make, any fee. What is the best for this client? So if you genuinely mean that and focus on that and do what's best for the client, that client's going to always call you back. Because trust me, all they need to, they go to other clients, other customers before, other brokerage firms before, different than us, it's people see the difference. And number one, like our logo is a lion for a reason. The lion hunts together. It's not just a solo, like a tiger's. Tigers hunt by themselves. And unfortunately, most big shops have more of a tiger mentality than they do a lion mentality. And I've seen it firsthand. I've seen, you know, the desk mate across from the other desk mate cut the throat of the other one over a fee. When at the end of the day, you both have the same business cards. And at the end of the day, you should be taking care of the client more than you are yourself. And so something as fundamentally simple to that, to me as that, is one of the biggest things that make us different. Everybody in our shop knows the biggest thing that we got to take care of is the client. If that means our fee is cut in half or whatever, did the client's problem get solved? Is the client happy? Will the client be better off in the next 2-3 years with their business growing? And if those answers are yes, then those clients will keep calling you.
Now, you are based in Atlanta. How do you all do business across the nation?
So we're probably doing work right now, and I'm saying about 38 or 40 states. The good news, what you just said, we are in Atlanta. We can cover 80% of the United States in 2 hours, jumping on a Delta plane, you know, on a Delta flight. So we self-service majority of all our deals. But for the ones that we may need some help on or something, we may have a joint venture partner, some folks that we've done work with before in the past and continue to do work with. You know, just it helps build great relationships over the years. So we know a lot of people from, you know, north, south, east, and west. So we can cover a lot of territory. And the goal is also just to continue to grow, to continue to grow with our clients. As clients continue to need more services, we want to be able to provide more service.
Is the commercial real estate market similar to the homeowner market?
I would say in one respect, you know, ebbs and flows, supply and demand. Right now, you know, the office market is taking a hit because a lot of people have not really returned back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of places have overbuilt, so there's a lot of office. So, but, you know, when it's tough for landlords, it's actually better for clients because this is a great time for a tenant to reconsider if their lease is about to come up, ideally within 2 years, particularly if you got a full floor, a lot of space. You want to get in front of that at least 2 years before it's time to move. If you got 100 people, 500 people trying to move, you need time to do that. So I tell people time is either your enemy or your friend. So if you've got at least a couple of years left and you're considering some big moves, this is the time to have those conversations, particularly now where the market is really tough for the landlord, but could be really good deals struck for the tenants. And this is the time to come in and do longer leases and that kind of thing. So we're doing a lot of that right now in terms of, I used to call blend and extend. It's a little modification of that now, but it's, you know, it's supply and demand. But right now, you know, we've always been on the tenant side since I left the landlord business back in the day. You know, these ebbs and flows, it's about how can you take advantage of those on behalf of a client, on behalf of your client.
What does the term pure tenant representation mean?
Pure tenant rep means we only represent tenants and occupiers of space. We do not represent landlords. So you won't go down the street and see T. Dallas Smith and Company building on a sign on a building. So that's 99.9% of the time that's the case, that we only represent our tenants. Now, we may have an example where maybe a tenant who's been in a building, they're in a 50,000 square foot, 100,000 square foot building, but they're going to sell that building and they're getting ready to move into a landlord's building because they want to get out of the landlord business and just be a tenant. And so we may end up having to sell that building to help them. But 99% of the time, we're purely just on the occupier and the tenant services, not on the landlord side too. For me, I feel like that's a conflict. How can I represent the building and now I'm representing you as a client? Who am I really loyal to? And so for me to not have that conflict, it's easier just to say, hey, I'm only representing you in this transaction. Like, I wouldn't go into court, represent both the plaintiff and the defendant, right? So to me, that's what it feels like. So we're pure tenant rep. We represent only tenants or occupiers of space.
Mr. Smith, before we run out of time, talk to us about the Westside Future Fund.
Westside Future Fund will be about 10 years next year. I'm the chair this year. I was born and raised in the West Side. The West Side Future Fund was started around the time when Mercedes-Benz Stadium was being built. Mm-hmm. And this was something that Arthur Blank and Dan Cathy, see Sprecher wanted to do something that would be impactful. The question was, how do we put a $2 billion stadium on one side over here, and then you've got people living in blighted areas? What can we do about it? So they started this thing called the West Side Future Fund. West Side Future Fund, one of the biggest things that we do is we help to keep the taxes low for residents that's been there, legacy residents who've been there for years, way before the stadium came. You know, you start bringing in new development, values start going up, and if you've been there, your taxes can go up too. But we set up a scenario where there's monies that go into West Side Future Fund that we help these people, the legacy residents, cap their taxes. So even as property values start going up, they won't be paying more for their taxes. We're also buying a lot of property. We've impacted over $120 million in different projects over on the west side, mostly in the form of single-family homes. And those homes are being subsidized through philanthropic forces within the West Side Future Fund for residents who qualify. And those residents who qualify for new homes, we're looking for legacy residents. They have some kind of reference within the HBCU area, whether it's Morehouse, Spelman, Clark, Morris Brown, teachers, went to school there, you went to high school in the area, you have preference with the West Side Future Fund for what we call home on the west side. And so I'd encourage anybody who's listening to this to just go to our website, the westsidefuturefund.com, and you can find more about the west side on home on the west side. I mean, we got a lot of stuff that's happening over in that area. For me, it is the one area I would tell people to really take a look at on the west side. Got a new park in that area. The Beltline is in the area. And again, the house that I have, I'm 2 miles from the front door of Mercedes-Benz Stadium, a mile and a half.
Where have you seen the greatest shift in demand for your services?
Well, I guess larger companies, just about every large company. We represented Microsoft when they came to Atlanta. We represented Nike, Airbnb, a lot of big companies. So they pick the ones who are good at what they do. I mean, like if you want a lawyer, you want the lawyer who specializes in whatever it is the case that you want, right? So these companies are learning that they can save a lot of money with people who, this is all I've ever done. For 43 years, I've been doing commercial real estate and primarily representing tenants. So a lot of stuff can be hidden in a lease that can cost a company a lot of money. And conversely, if you've got the right representation, can help you save a lot of money.
T. Dallas Smith, founder and CEO of T. Dallas Smith and Company, the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the nation. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters helping to bring diversity to the airwaves. You can find more shows like In Black America in the NPR Network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr.
Well, folks, it's been 2 weeks since the election, and some folks have still not gotten over what happened. A lot of talk, a lot of speculation, a lot of blame, finger pointing, all that good stuff. Karen Hunter on the Karen Hunter Show looks at a few different things. First, she'll look at the election, and then, since we haven't been talking about it much, take a look at Palestine.
Oprah's making, oh my goodness. Okay,
how
so,
you doing?
Hey, Oprah, I feel like you number one, you shouldn't have left television. And then after you left television, I feel like you got a little out of touch, and then like almost like Obama and them. Now we you know, people ain't really messing with you like that anymore. But that can happen, you know, and I saw it happen. Jon Stewart left. He came back. It's been a little lukewarm, you know, because when you leave and try to come back, and people forget, or they get over you because we're people. And then they move on, and then now you're heavily scrutinized because you came back into a world that has changed. But you might be warranted getting this smoke, ma'am, primarily because everybody is in your pocketbook. So we know that you're a billionaire. So when the reports come out, because it's public record that the Harpo Productions got two checks for $500,000 signed by the Harris campaign, it looks like Oprah took $1 million. Now, most of us are not sophisticated enough to know that, you know, your production company got paid. But then we're also, I think, smart enough to realize that aren't you the head of the production company? So while the check didn't go to Oprah Winfrey, you're a billionaire. Why you ain't pay for it? That's how people are, because people are in people's pockets. You could afford it. You could have paid for the thing, the live streaming, if you cared that much about Kamala being the damn president. But again, the campaign raised $1 billion. The money ain't come to Urban View. Let me just say that with my full chest. They did some ads towards the last week. But, y'all, anyway, people got paid. I'm like, oh, my God. How does this hurt her legacy? Does it hurt her legacy? Do you care? I feel like a lot of people don't care, and they were mad about that, and then they're wondering if Beyonce got paid. You know, I'm just like, did Cardi B get paid? And it does kind of raise. I think we need to take money out of politics. And if you are a celebrity and you care about a particular candidate, then you put your money on the line and make sure that they get elected. You just got to do that. If you care that much about democracy. This shouldn't have been but she got a production company. People got to get paid. So Oprah responded. TMZ found her in the streets, too. Y'all are dirty, TMZ. They found her. I don't know where she is. She got a very nice luxury car. It was beautiful. And she was out walking. She didn't have on no makeup. I'm like, y'all found Oprah, like, out in the streets. And they were like, excuse me, Oprah. Oh, you look so good, Oprah. And a guy with a British accent. And they were like, did you take $1 million? She was like, I did not take $1 million. And then she went on and responded. She said, thank you so much. Somebody said, y'all thinking Oprah's support can be purchased is beyond me. And then Oprah said, thank you so much saying this. I want to high five you and give you a hug. Usually I'm reluctant. Is this for real? I hope this is not AI. Usually I'm reluctant to respond to rumors in general, but these days I realize that if you don't stop a lie, it just gets bigger. I was not paid a dime. My time and energy was my way of supporting the campaign. For the live streaming event in September, my production company, Harpo, was asked to bring in set design, lights, cameras, microphones, crew, producers, and every other item necessary, including the benches and chairs we sat on to put on a live production. I did not take any personal fee. However, the people who worked on the production needed to be paid and were. End of story. But $1 million, though? Okay, I'm going to mind my business. I'm clearly, that's out of my price range. I ain't never put on production that big, so I don't know what these things cost, but I'm just thinking, you couldn't have covered that? I'm just asking. I would have, if I had $1 billion, which I don't, I would have covered it. I just would have, especially if it was that important. But maybe it's just me, I don't know.
My days are cooler, nights are warmer, and I put the blame on you.
Ha!
Let's get into money, power, and politics, my favorite topics. On Election Day, voters sent a clear message about how they feel about the economy. They were enraged by a sense that things are not fair, from groceries to rent or insurance, the stress of the cost of living, and feelings that others are getting ahead. And they're listening to media stories about migrants getting hotel rooms and debit cards, but their son is still living at home. Feeling that lack of fairness drove so many voters to Trump. But now those voters and the rest of us are about to find out what Trump's policies would actually do. Here to discuss, two of my all-time faves, Dan Nathan is here, co-founder of Risk Reversal, CNBC contributor and host of the On the Tape podcast, and David Gura, correspondent for Bloomberg and host of the Big Take podcast. Okay, what do you make of this issue of fairness? Rightly or wrongly, a lot of people felt like the economy is working for others and not for them. And there's this idea that Trump is going to fix that. So what happens now?
Well, I think be careful what you wish for, right? So if we heard a lot about the tariffs that Trump wants to put in place, I think that's one thing that a lot of voters just don't understand how they work. I know that you've been talking about it a whole heck of a lot for months and months. I think one of the problems the Biden administration had very bad surrogates on the economy. We've talked about
that. You and I have talked about this
again and again. And, you know, when you just think about it, we had unemployment at really 50-year lows or so. We had inflation coming down from 9% to 2.5% or so in the last 2 years. Interest rates started to come down. I mean, the economy was getting better, and they had a really, they're handing off a very good economy right now. So if you think about, I get the fairness thing, okay? But at the end of the day, a lot of the policies that they've articulated, big tax cuts for corporations, tariffs and the like, it's really inflationary. So if we see inflation starting to go back up, then the Federal Reserve is going to have to start raising interest rates again. And we're going to be in the exact same situation we were, let's say, 2 years ago.
What do you think? We all know that tariffs play really well on a rally stage, make the other guys pay. But like, now it's time for this thing to actually happen.
Yeah. And what you have to believe is that the whole school of economic theory and proven history goes out the window. And these tariff policies that Donald Trump's going to put in place are going to do something that everyone says they're not going to do. So Dan's point, we know they're going to be hugely inflationary. We also just don't know, beyond these big numbers, very few details about how they're actually going to work. But as Dan's saying, we have an economy now that's humming, doing great. Relatively speaking, yes, there are people who feel left out. There's a lot of opportunity here to really scuttle that.
Do you think he's actually going to do it? Do you think day one he's going to go full bore, tariffs across the board, appoint super right-wingers, you know, Peter Navarro? Or, I talked about it in the last segment, do you think there's this chance that Trump sees this opportunity, that he calls up a Jamie Dimon, a Larry Fink, and says, like, be with me, man. Be my Treasury Secretary. Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's optimistic. But if you think about who's right at his side right now, it's Elon Musk. Elon Musk has said repeatedly that if we do not put trade barriers on Chinese electric vehicles, they're going to destroy everything. I think he used the word demolish the rest of the auto industry, you know, globally. So I think Elon will follow through on the sorts of things that are important to him. His worldview is probably a bit more nuanced than that of Trump's or anyone else that Trump puts around him. So I would suspect that they're going to actually, I mean, what was his thing? Promises made, promises kept. They're going to have to do a bunch of this stuff because, again, if he thinks he has a mandate, he's only going to piss off a whole host of people that he brought over towards, you know, his camp over the last, obviously, month or two.
Well, let's talk about this because Rachel Maddow has a new piece out in The New Yorker all about how authoritarians really work. And the way it really works is they're not interested in politics or policy. They're interested in enriching themselves, right? Corruption and enriching themselves. Many people have likened a Trump's career or political career or aspirations to that of an authoritarian. So let's talk for a moment about his businesses and how well he could do. Because remember last time around, we're saying, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Well, now the wheels are truly going to come off because no rules were ever put in place over the last 4 years.
So Rachel's written a great piece, which draws a lot from history, and it's well worth reading. But your question is a very good one. And I think back on 2017, there was that news conference. Donald Trump came out with his lawyer, talked about all the barriers that he'd put in place on conflicts of interest. I think this time that's all out the window.
It's not even going to pretend.
Not even going to come up. There's going to be no pretense that that's going to happen. So you look at his portfolio today, he's got these kind of strange digital cryptocurrency assets that we don't really know what they are, what the companies he's starting. He's got these NFTs that are out there. Then there's the old school real estate stuff. And I, you know, Bloomberg had a big piece on that this week. And I think what's so fascinating is A lot of leases are up. He's going to be renegotiating. And sort of what he has now, talk about the art of the deal, is just fear on the other side of the table. I don't want to piss off the president of the United States. And so you can talk about his worth, his net worth, and all of that. He just comes now from a business perspective with so much more leverage than he had before, and I think it's quite clear he's going to exploit that going forward.
Yeah, I mean, retribution. I mean, he said he's going to do that. He's going to be a dictator for a day, and I think that's probably for months. And, you know, Elon Musk, and I hate to keep coming back to this, but I think the idea that he is going to be a shadow president is something that people should really start to think about. If you think about what Elon's stock just did, Tesla, it just gained $300 billion in market cap since last Wednesday.
So that $150 million he spent on the campaign, pennies.
It's just saying something about, obviously, the way forward here, how we're going to be governed, and the fact that you have someone like him who's going to be able to kind of press his thumb on the scales the way he did prior to the election with money, the way he used Twitter or X, you know, his own platform to kind of move around misinformation, disinformation. I just think, why would you suspect that's not going to happen, you know, for the next few years?
Well, Elon Musk, like Donald Trump, likes this idea of the administration having influence over the Federal Reserve. Like, that's all well and good because Donald Trump doesn't like, you know, separate but equal. But how is that going to play? Because when the bond market says basta, it doesn't matter who's the president.
It was clear at that press conference last week.
Jay Powell. No.
Yes. No. And, you know, before all of this, a lot was made that he's not an academic economist. He doesn't have a PhD. He is a lawyer. And it was clear at that press conference that he's going to fight this. If Donald Trump wants him to resign or tries to get rid of him, he's going to take any steps he can to prevent that from happening. But the sanctity of the independence of the Federal Reserve is so important. It has been the case for many decades, going back to the Nixon administration when that was kind of tested. Look, you talk about the bond market. There's Fed independence kind of in a vacuum, but beyond that, the ripple effects of jeopardizing that could be huge on the whole financial system. I think that Jay Powell recognizes that. I sense from what we saw in that, you know, tweet from Senator Mike Lee and what we saw from Elon Musk is that's going to be tested. I think that could get quite nasty.
Reports of his picks for key posts are beginning to emerge. Topping the list, Marco Rubio, whose sources say Trump is likely to tap for the role of Secretary of State. Or when it comes to policies in the Middle East region, where I am, we still don't know what Donald Trump wants to do when he assumes office. What we do know is that he says he wants to bring peace. How he plans to achieve that is still unclear. Over the next 2.5 months, it will, one assumes, become clearer, and we are already seeing key positioning from stakeholders in the region who would be key partners for any deal of the century, as Trump liked to call it, peace in this region. Saudi Arabia, for starters, a country that was on the cusp of normalization with Israel before the October 7th attacks and the ensuing bombardment of Gaza. Normalization, a key priority for the Trump administration, of course. The kingdom has most recently said no normalization without a Palestinian state, or at least a credible path towards an independent state. And that reality, well, it does seem as if it is becoming less and less real. Just yesterday, Israel's new foreign minister, Gideon Saar, was asked about the possibility of a Palestinian state and, in a word, replied no, saying it would pose a security threat to Israel. And at a high-profile meeting in Riyadh on Monday, Saudi's crown prince gave one of his harshest criticisms since the war started, accusing Israel of genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. All of this as Israel's far-right finance minister orders preparations for the annexation of settlements in the occupied West Bank, stressing that Trump's victory brings what he calls an important opportunity for Israel. Right, we've laid the table. Let's look to see what we can do with what is on there. Alan Pinkas is an Israeli diplomat and Trita Parsi, an expert on US-Iranian relations, author of Losing an Enemy. It's good to have you both. Trita, let me start with you. What should we take out of the meeting in Riyadh yesterday?
I think it's a very strong indication of where some of the Arab states in the Persian Gulf are leaning towards. The analysis among some of the hawks in the Trump circle is that they can go back to the situation in 2016 and 2017, where they laid the groundwork for some form of an Arab-Israeli alliance against Iran, which the Arabs at the time were quite in favor of. Things have changed, however. At this point, it's very clear both the Saudis and the Emiratis want to make sure that they absolutely stay out of any war that involves the United States, Israel, and Iran. And part of the reason for this, of course, is the anger amongst their own populations with what Israel has been doing in Gaza and the West Bank and increasingly in Lebanon, but also because of realization that Iran's ballistic missiles are so effective that they penetrated Israel's many layers of air defenses, and as a result, will also be able to penetrate whatever the United States has provided these countries. So they're much more vulnerable vis-a-vis Iran as well than what they thought they were back in 2016. All of this is adding to their desire to stay out of any type of a conflict and help de-escalate the situation.
I want to come very specifically to where you believe Iran's sort of thinking is at present, of course, represented at this meeting in Riyadh. And that is a change since 2016. And of course, the first Trump administration, the region has changed significantly. The architecture moving around since the last time that Donald Trump was in power. Let's hold that thought just for the time being. Alon, let me bring you in on the Israeli side. And this is, I'm quoting Faisal Abbas here, who writes for Arab News, and I thought it was a very good line. On the Israeli side, given what we've just heard Trita say, Benjamin Netanyahu's hard right coalition and battlefield successes, Faisal says, are hindering any sort of apparent opportunity for compromise at this point. Would you agree with that, given what we are hearing from his appointees, his finance minister, across settlements, and indeed from his foreign minister, a one-word answer when asked about a Palestinian state, the answer was no.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, it sounds very catchy to say no, but if there was a follow-up question of, well, what then do you propose, you will get nothing because they have nothing. And that's probably the tragedy of it. On the one hand, you have the finance minister, whom you mentioned several times. And he's a right-wing fanatic. He's driven by biblical dictates and all kinds of theological messianism, pretending to be policy. On the other hand, you have Mr. Netanyahu, who's not exactly a religious messianic, but he's become a geopolitical messianic. He thinks he can actually topple the regime in Iran. He thought so, by the way, in 2002 when he advocated that the U.S. Invade Iraq because that would reverberate, quote unquote, in the region and bring about the fall of Iran. His dream, his geopolitical ideal scenario for the last year was to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran. I doubt that would happen under Donald Trump. So both these gentlemen, Mr. Smotrich wants to annex the West Bank because the Bible says so, and Mr. Netanyahu wants to bring about a regime change in Tehran, both may be disappointed with what they'll see coming out of the Trump White House.
And how significant is this leverage that the Saudis hold over sort of, you know, what happens next with regard normalization? I mean, the Saudis have made it very, very clear at this point, without a credible path to an independent Palestinian state, there will be no normalization. Look, you know, nobody's prepared to say what that, very specifically, what that credible path might look like. But Tehran must be, you know, this is sort of music to the ears of Tehran to a certain extent, who clearly treat them not looking for a normalized region with Israel anytime soon. So let's just have a go at that. You know, how much leverage do the Saudis hold? Alon, to your mind first.
I think they hold tremendous leverage over Trump. I think it's a mistake. I mean, you said that in your introduction, and that was the conventional wisdom before October 7th, 2023, according to which there was a trilateral deal in the works. A U.S.-Saudi defense alliance and a Saudi-Israeli normalization with no one giving a damn about the Palestinian issue. Okay, I'm not sure that would have worked, but it doesn't matter. It's all academic now because October 7th occurred and the ensuing war, and the Saudis cannot go back to October 6th just because Donald Trump is going to ask them. Now, this is how it's going to play out. I won't take too much of Trita's time. The Trump is going to come to the Saudis and say, join the Abraham Accords. Let's expand this. Let's create a regional loose alliance, even though he's averse to alliances. But this is what he's going to say, because that shows that he's doing something that Biden failed to do. The Saudis are going to say, okay, Mr. President, we're all ready for this, provided that the Israelis show us, as you said, Becky, a clear path to a Palestinian state. Trump is going to go to Netanyahu, who's going to say, not a problem. I'll take care of that. Don't worry about that. We'll start a process. Trump will then say, I'm good with that, right? He's going to go back to the Saudis, and the Saudis are going to say, absolutely not. Mr. President, Netanyahu has been manipulating American presidents for the better part of the last 20 years. He's going to manipulate you. Unless we see clear, tangible signs of such a process, we're not going to participate in this game. And their leverage over Trump, because he's transactional, right, because of the oil, is much greater than Israel.
Yep, fascinating. I want to bring you in, Trita, then. What's the strategic calculus here for Iran? After all, back in from the cold with the Saudis and the UAE, for example, warmer relations, but keep your friends close and your enemies closer, you know, is clearly, the sort of strategic calculus potentially from this region. What's the thinking in Tehran at this point?
I think the first thing the Iranians are concerned about at this point is to see exactly what type of an Iran policy the new Trump administration will adopt. As you know, the Iranians, particularly the new president, came in with a very strong desire of restarting negotiations with the United States. They amended some of their positions, added greater flexibility, agreeing to make a deal with the U.S. directly, even with Trump, that doesn't necessarily build off of the JCPOA or is identical to the JCPOA. But then Trump has come in, and I think they're looking at it very nervously. On the one hand, they recognize that Trump actually wants a deal. The question is, will he have a team around him that will help ensure that a deal is secured, or will it be like it was last time, where he had a team around him that actually pursued a policy that was far more likely and designed to bring about a military confrontation between the United States and Iran, and essentially duped Trump into that direction? Mm-hmm. So the nervousness on the Iranian side is whether Trump actually is capable of coming to a deal, depending on who he is appointing. And some of the decisions that were made yesterday, I'm sure, has made the Iranians more nervous with names such as Rubio, et cetera.
As you say, winning is everything, stupid. And it does look, from where you sit, that Donald Trump won everything. He has won the popular, the electoral, the Senate, potentially the House. He dominates the Supreme Court and has really made inroads with demographics that used to be overwhelmingly for the Democrats. So how do you explain, particularly for an international audience, the biggest swing to the right in the United States since Ronald Reagan?
Well, first of all, winning is everything, and it's everything. It's above loyalty. Without winning, there's nothing. And of course, the country wanted change, and the vice president's campaign decided they would not offer that. They asked Vice President Harris, what should have done different than President Biden? And she said she can't think anything.
Okay, so hold on, because I have that. I have that, and I want to play it. James, hold on, because I'm going to play it, and then you can describe it. Let's just play this bit.
A flood of illegals, skyrocketing prices, global chaos, and Kamala wouldn't change a thing.
Would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind.
Nothing will change with Kamala.
So, James Carville, that was a Trump ad. Would you say that was, you know, decisive and extremely effective?
I do. I think that answer was the decisive moment of the entire campaign. But Christine, we should not overinterpret this. This is not a 1980 realignment election. He's not going to get 50% of the popular vote. The House, they'll probably win it by a razor thin minority. So we don't need to over. It was a bad night. People wanted change. We resolutely refused to give them a different direction than they wanted, which we could have done. We could have had an open primary process, and we have staggering talent in the party. We could have demonstrated that. We chose not to do this. I mean, a lot of these decisions were made at the high top level of the Democratic Party, and they were not very wise decisions.
James Carville, you say don't overthink this. It's not as big a swing as 1980. Yeah. But Trump can genuinely claim a mandate from the American people. I mean, let's face it, the convictions, the impeachments, all the other things that have been going on for all this time. And he can say, and the assassination attempts, I survived all of this and I'm here. He can take it as a mandate if he wins all levers of government, can't he?
Well, we can take anything that he wants. What the Democrats need to do is be an opposition party. And the opposition, like, it starts right now. Because I can tell you, this transition and the inauguration is going to be like everything else in Trump land, a giant grift. It needs to be exposed, and it needs to be exposed pronto. And Democrats have to have a mechanism in place to do that. But I don't know how you claim a mandate if you don't get 50%. You can say, I won the election, and you can certainly say, I told people I was going to do all of this, and a majority of them voted for me anyway. But I would be very reluctant to swing the M word around here. I would say he won the election, but I'd be okay. Go ahead.
No, I understand what you're saying. But as you said, you know, Trump has shown us that he can create a reality. And what he's done with this mandate that he apparently thinks he has is so far, you know, put all the loyalists in, and it's a very, you know, it's a huge sort of signpost to the very hardline policies that he said he would do. Well, what can the Democrats do about it?
Well, what you do is, you know, you're not spending anybody. You live in a place where you have an opposition party. You act like an opposition party. You do not have power. So you do research, you launch investigations, you make talking points, you get people out front, you organize the opposition, you point out the weaknesses in what they're doing. And they're going to do things that people never dreamed of. And when they do, you have to be there with an alternative. But you're an opposition party. Opposition parties do not have power. We need to get over that. But we have the power to expose, we have the power to propose alternatives. We have power to be different. We have to exercise that power. Mm. But I can't sit around and mope around about an election that's already over. I got to think about the next election, like 2026. And we got to think about how do we organize this opposition? What is the rallying point? Where does the opposition start? I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions here that need to be answered and answered pronto.
Thank you for listening.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Did you know that Lyme disease is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year? Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.lymediseaseassociation.org.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 on your radio, your FM radio, WRCT.org on your web browsing device of choice. It is 7 o'clock. That means it is time for the radio calendar. Here are some things going on in our fair city, like the Three Rivers Film Festival, which runs November 13th through the 20th and will showcase exciting and thought-provoking independent feature films from around the world that you won't see anywhere else. Along with the screenings, come enjoy question and answer sessions with cast and crew, after parties, a chance to vote on your favorite films, and more. This expansive 8-day event will be inclusive and fun. Films will screen downtown at the August Wilson African American Cultural Center and the Harris Theater, and in Sewickley at the Lindsay Theater. The festival will also include 4 films screening virtually throughout the run. For more information, visit filmpittsburgh.org or send them email at info@filmpittsburgh.org. And you can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, and bass to perform popular music from the 1920s and 1930s. The Pittsburgh Banjo Club rehearses at the Allegheny Elks Lodge, number 339, which is located at 400 Cedar Avenue in Pittsburgh's North Side. Food and refreshments are available. Reservations must be made by Tuesday at 5 p.m. for each Wednesday event. You can do that by giving them a call at 412-321-1834. Other live music going on in our city tonight. Kurt Travis is at Preserving Underground along with Jeff Rickley. Mr. Smalls is hosting Better Lovers along with Full of Hell, Spy, and Cloakroom. Dave Shepard is playing at Club Cafe with a full band. They're playing along with Noah G. Fowler. Nowhere Wolves are having an album release show at the Funhouse at Mr. Smalls tonight, along with Normal Creatures, Samurai, and The Stolen Stitches. Ronnie Baker Brooks is at the Pittsburgh Winery. Ali X will be at Spirit Hall along with Violet Chachki. Tall Heights will be at the Thunderbird. Tomorrow night, Corey Wong featuring Mark Lethierry will be at Stage A along with Couch. Beach Vacation and Colatura are playing at the Club Cafe. Code 9 will be at Cobra. Brian Dunn is at the Funhouse at Mr. Smalls along with Justin Bennett and the Debtors. Horse Whisper and The Empty Hand will be at the Government Center along with Sastava and Bath Time. Pittsburgh Winery is hosting Gray Short along with Vida Chai and Lenny Green. Vida Chai is a good name, I think. The Myla Shadell. Sorry, Myla, I don't know how to say your last name. Anyway, the Myla Shadell, I'll say, quartet is at Con Alma tonight. Tomorrow night. Thursday night. Don't rush things. On Friday, Wyatt Flores will be at Stage A along with Noeline Hoffman. Christopher Mark Jones and the Roots Ensemble are at Sunny Hill. At Pittsburgh Winery, Calliope presents Allison Brown. Club Cafe is hosting Phenom along with Meg Elsier. Mother of Earl is having an